Hello everybody, welcome back to The Doubters on Thursday the 9th of July, even though it feels like it could be Thursday the 9th of October at the moment here in the UK. Weather's not great. We've got a guest here today. We've got Elisa Barkan. Is that a correct announcement, Elisa? Is that a good announcement of your name?
Yeah,
it's acceptable. Pretty close, acceptable. Okay. Elisa is joining us from her home in Cambridgeshire. And Elisa is a financial coach and consultant. We're going to be talking about the link between money and self-doubt. We'll get onto that in a minute. So this is The Doubters. Anybody who's here for the first time, this is my private online community. And I use these sessions really as an explorative space. This is a space for learning. I set a topic with my guests and we explore the topic. We haven't planned what we're going to say. I'm really interested to see what's going to come out. Slightly nervous, I must say, talking about money. It's not something that I do really easily. Anybody does really easily. And that's why Elisa is a great person to come along and have that. Elisa has created this YouTube channel called The Savvy Corner, which is especially for having having open conversations about money. So I think Elisa, would I be correct in saying that one of your things is, you know, trying to get away from the shame and have more open conversations about money?
Yeah. When I first moved to the UK, which was more than a decade ago now, I realised how much of a taboo subject money is compared to my home country.
Oh, really?
And I didn't realise that people, for example, would rather share details about their intimate lives than talk about money, right?
It's true. It's true. People would rather talk about self-doubt than money. And that's a sensitive subject.
Yeah. So it's a very taboo subject. And I thought to myself, well, if we're not going to talk about it, how are we going to be able to solve it? Because yeah. I could see a lot of people struggling with money from the clients that I work with, from the conversations that I have privately with people. And one of the things that they say to me the most is, nobody knows about this. I'm only confident talking about it with you because kind of you're a stranger. You're not, you know, you don't know me in my personal life. You are not going to judge me. Or if you are, it's not so harsh on me because we are kind of strangers to each other. So yeah, my aim here is to make money a subject of discussion and to kind of remove the stigma that comes with talking about money and with how having a lot of money or not so much kind of brings you this status of either being better or worse off, or it has nothing to do with money. It all has to do with you and how you see yourself. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people see themselves through the lens of money and what that represents, the fact that they can't make as much or whatever in comparisons with other people. Mm-hmm. So because money is numeric in a way, it's very easy to make that comparison, but actually you don't really know what you're comparing with because you don't have all of the variables of the equation. People only let you see certain things. They let you see what they want to portray as being their financial situation, but sometimes, well, I would say possibly most times, it's not actually the reality. So
yeah, wow. Okay, you jumped right into the conversation there, which is amazing. Comparisons and all sorts. So this is really relevant to self-doubt. Okay, I like to really introduce people through my connection with them. So I'll just back up for a minute and do that, and then we'll get into this conversation. And just to explain, a couple of people here live, people may join us throughout the session. Feel free to contribute through the chat box. Well, through the session, that's fine. We will open up at about 20 to the hour, and anybody can come on and ask a question or make a contribution on the recording. And we will also close the recording off at about 10 to the hour. So if you want to come on and off the recording, then that's fine too. So, you know, feel free to jump in at any point or those points I've said. Yeah, so that's how we run here. Now, so Elisa, I met you through the wonderful Dori Clark. We were at one of her events together, and we were actually in the queuing up for a selfie together with Dori.
Yeah.
I consider anybody that I meet through Dori Clark. If you don't know who Dori Clark is, where have you been? You need to go and look her up. She's amazing. Now, she was doing a speaking event over here. You got something of hers there.
Yeah.
And one of her books.
This is where my journey with Dori started. And then it developed into more than that. But yeah, I definitely recommend that book, Entrepreneurial You, anyone who's running a business and is looking to monetize their expertise and have multiple sources of income.
Oh yeah,
that's a really great book.
I latched onto Dory after I trained as a coach, and there was so much advice out there, and you know what she gives is really sound. I love what she does. So yeah, I consider anybody that I meet through Dory as somebody who's having impeccable judgment, of course. Yeah, and we've already spoken a little bit about the topic here, about you know money and self-doubt, and you know perhaps you know. So let me just sort of say what I see the link is. Now, it's weird because I was thinking about this just today before we started, and actually only one client has ever come up to me and said, oh, my self-doubt is around money. That's only ever happened once, you know, really attached that self-doubt to money. But it often feels like a bit of a backstory to the challenges around self-doubt and security, especially. You know, money is quite a big factor in all of this stuff, the, you know, the security and the control and all that kind of stuff that comes through with it. So it's often a bit of a backstory, but maybe we'll get into that a little bit more as we go through the conversation. But maybe just start out by asking, so it was interesting, actually, you said just at the beginning there that in your country, you're from Romania, is that correct?
Yeah.
You said there wasn't this shame in talking around money.
No, so just to put a bit of context around that, when I was born, Romania was still a communist country. So I didn't live in communism for very long because the regime fell shortly after. But it's interesting, with the newly found democracy, actually the new mentality didn't come. It took a lot longer to shift the way people thought about their lives and the way that they lived their lives. So I was basically growing up in a democracy, but day-to-day life was pretty much the same as it was before the revolution. So people were for a very long time on the same level financially and also socially, if you want. There were no social blankets as such. That kind of developed a little bit later. So the fact that we were talking about money is because you were probably making, or my parents, whatever, they were making the same as their friends anyway. So it wasn't so much of a case of let's compare each other, because there wasn't really that much to compare against. Communism tried to keep everyone kind of on the same page. You were given a job when you finished school. And yeah, there were differences in how much people earned, but not significant differences. There were, of course, a few people at the very top who were making ridiculous amounts of money, but you as an average citizen didn't have access to that. So we all grew up knowing about how much our parents are making. And, you know, the older kids, let's say, or the older siblings or whatever, when they got their first job, everyone knew how much they were being paid. And if their parents knew, then their parents' friends would know as well. So it was this kind of alignment. And we didn't talk about money in terms of comparison, but rather what to do with it and kind of how to use it as a resource, because it was really quite difficult, especially in the first few years. People had money, but they had nothing to buy because the shops were all empty.
Yeah.
So the dictator was trying to pay off the external debt of the country, and therefore everything was exported. So I remember my parents searching for months and months and months because they wanted to furnish my bedroom. They just couldn't find the furniture. So they had the money, and I remember always seeing money. It was visible in our house. We kept it in a drawer. Cash, right?
Yeah.
So I grew up seeing money all the time. It was there. It was accessible. I could go and reach it, whatever. But to wait for more than 6 months to find furniture, and the only reason they found it was because it had some sort of flaw and they refused it for export, and therefore they had to sell it internally. And it was about 400 miles away from where my parents were. That's where the furniture was located, and they had to go and bring that into, you know, the city where I grew up in. So, you know, our conversations about money were very different than the conversations about money that people have now. But I just grew up being used to it, and being used to seeing money, and being used to having, you know, minimal amounts that everyone else had.
Yeah.
And almost being used to it not, you know, money didn't do that much for me. Because if you had it and you couldn't buy anything with it,
what's the point? That's really fascinating, honestly. We could go down a whole rabbit hole talking about your background and your experience of, you know, really interested in that. And I guess what I'm hearing you saying is that there wasn't that comparison element because everybody knew. So there was a whole transparency there, that whole layer is taken out. But also the fact of that, you know, the value of money, if you can't buy stuff with it, what does that mean? But also the fact of, I guess, you know, when you got your bedroom furniture, they probably meant quite a lot to you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it because it was something new and it was a set for the whole room, which was unusual, whatever. Yeah. But I didn't, you know, I had my own money as a kid and I kept that on my bedroom radiator, right? So that money couldn't do much for me either. It was just this dynamics that we had both as kids, and my parents were dealing with the same thing as adults. But I grew up always having money for one way or another. I'm not saying huge amounts of money, but I knew that if I needed some money, there was some there anyway, because I liked seeing it accumulate. There wasn't much that I could do with it anyway. So I just had this sense of satisfaction to see more of it, whatever. And then later on, I got into investing and all that kind of stuff. But for me, that was the start of good financial habits, to just put some money aside because, you know, even if I wanted to spend it, there wasn't much to spend it on. So, and my parents were always, my dad especially, he said, instead of spending this money on something that you'll have to replace later, why not spend a little bit more money that will last you for a very, very long time and buy something of quality. So that kind of stayed with me as well. I guess it was a sort of a, you know, knowing that maybe later you can't buy that thing again, you might as well just buy something now that it's of good quality and it will last you for a long time, because you don't have to go through the buying
principle.
Process.
It's a great principle. I kind of learned that one the hard way, I think, you know, spend more and invest rather than having to replace it. So it's just in. So what I think I'll actually, as you're talking, I'm comparing my background and money. And, you know, and I think this is possibly one of the significant points around our money story. You know, you talk about helping people rewrite their financial story is the beliefs that we get as children. And, you know, it's really interesting as I'm listening to you, I'm contrasting it with my experience growing up, which was entirely different around money. So I'm the youngest of six, I have five older brothers, I'm the only girl, youngest of six. And my parents were, I don't know why they had six children. I mean, honestly, when they got together, they had all the hope, you know. My dad was an accountant, actually, but they just couldn't, they was unmanageable. Their just whole relationship around money was unmanageable. So it's interesting. So I've looked into our genealogy recently, our family history, and my family story on my dad's side is one of social mobility, but up and then down. So up in the Victorian era, but then down through later time. And it kind of went down through misfortune, actually, through addictions and illness. And my dad got ill before I was born. So I was born into this sort of family with chaos. And one of my brother kind of really made me think recently, because he said that, you know, our dad grew up going to, you know, one of the private schools in the country and that kind of high society type stuff. And he was not equipped for not having money. Mm-hmm. So he was constantly insecure. And I remember, you know, talk of like 8 years old, talk about, oh, we're going to lose the house. You know, we're going to lose the house. You know, that was the constant narrative. We're going to lose the house. We didn't lose the house, but that was always, and it's like these are some of the messages that stayed with me around and have shaped my relationship with money, if you like. So it's just interesting maybe to draw that comparison between where I'm coming from in this conversation and you.
It has a lot to do. So our situation now is a reflection of all of the beliefs that we have accumulated from childhood until this point in time, and it's not as easy as that. It's the beliefs kind of make us feel in a certain way, and because of the way we feel, we act accordingly or we don't act, and based on those actions we see certain results. But it definitely comes from having certain beliefs around money, that sometimes we don't even know we have. And sometimes they're not even necessarily explicitly about money, but they still, they influence our financial situation. So I always tell people, you know, don't think that the beliefs that you have that don't contain the word money in them or whatever won't affect your financial situation. So I was talking about this the other day with someone who has one of their core values is helping people. So they are a coach as well. And because of that, that value is kind of in conflict with them charging people, because then they think, well, it's not really help if you're charging for it. So how can I charge for someone when I want to help them? Because I come from a place of, you know, kindness and being generous and genuinely trying to make things better for them. But then at the same time, I cannot run my business on pro bono work because I need to pay my bills. And so there's a whole conflict around, you know, having the value of being helpful as a core value, and you're thinking that has nothing to do with money. It's a perfectly, it might not, but in some cases it might. Yeah. So it's a very intricate kind of relationship between the beliefs that we have that are not explicitly related to money and how that affects our financial situation in one way or another.
I can relate to that, you know, that coaching story about wanting to help and then having to charge. Well, actually, you know, I was in a position where I didn't have to charge. So to begin with, so I was able to, I went into the, into my business with the purpose of what is it that I've got as a value? And I explored that without having to charge. And that kind of, and that allowed me to explore this whole concept, which is a bit of a weird way to set up a business, if you like. And it took me a long time to get onto that charging ladder, but I was okay with that. I was okay with that because I didn't need to charge. Do you know what I mean? But if you need to charge for your services, I'm glad that I didn't need to, because if I was coming into my coaching practice, like my helping business, and having to make money out of it, I think that would have made it a very different experience for me. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed that. But anyway, what was that? So I was going to say, so it's interesting. So the beliefs, I mean, this is something that really comes up around the self-doubt work. So what I do when coaching people around self-doubt, what they do is they come and I ask them for an example of where self-doubt shows up in their life. And, you know, when we, and we use that example as like a lens, because what comes out through that is we get into the core beliefs. And the beliefs there around self-doubt are often, well, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. You know, actually, that's what self-doubt is. It's an area in your life where you believe you're not good enough. But and that's a difficult truth to acknowledge, actually. But it is a truth. But it is a truth. And we don't get beyond that without acknowledging it as a truth. You know, because then I sort of talk about that being a layer of truth, but then also there's another truth underneath it that's driving that. If you like. Does that make sense?
I would say it's maybe not. I wouldn't call it the truth, but I would call it their truth.
Yeah. Oh, our truth. Yeah. When I say yeah. And that's almost like in acknowledging that I don't feel good enough in this area and accepting that I feel like this, that then we can get beyond it, if you like. And question, you know, what's underneath that truth, what's driving that truth, and get to the root of the story, which is often, you know, what you, we were talking about there are, you know, childhood stories often and beliefs you picked up as a
I usually start with the emotions. I ask people how they feel, because it's really difficult to say to say to them, so what are your beliefs around money? And they go, you know, but when you ask them how do you feel, things immediately come up. I feel inadequate, I feel guilty, I feel shame around my debt, I feel all sorts of stuff. And then if we take it from the emotion, it's easier to then identify. You must be feeling like this because you think you have a certain belief. So if you feel inadequate around money, it's because you think you're not good with numbers, or you don't understand math, or whatever it might be for them. Right? So yeah, starting with emotion, I think, is a very powerful thing, because emotions are something that we feel. We don't need to think about them. They just come up and we can express them. In at the same time, you don't want to be saying I feel bad or I feel good, because that's not nuanced enough. You want to go deep into what does bad look like for you, and explore those emotions in a bit more detail.
And I think that's where your service that you offer is probably quite unique as a financial coach, because it is going in on and exploring those emotions related to money rather than just the figures. You can do the figures and the numbers and understanding all that, you know, those statements and stuff like that as well. But
And I like to, you know, the clients that I work with, they're all very intelligent people. I don't want to insult their intelligence by explaining, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and if you spend 5, you'll be left with -1, which is debt. I mean, they understand that intellectually. And some of them are running budgets at work that are 7 figures or multiple 7 figures, and they're very good at it as well. So it's not a case of them not understanding this intellectually, which is why, you know, we will go through the, okay, let's put a budget together and let's make a plan, and how are you going to follow this plan, and let's put some action steps into place. But that only comes after, because you can have this amazing strategy, and they can follow it to the letter intellectually, but there's something else that's stopping them, right? Because if this was a knowledge problem, they would have been able to solve it. Because they understand intellectually, they are smart enough, good enough to understand how numbers work. It's just there's something else that comes into play when we talk about our own money, and that is the emotion. Because you don't have emotions around the money that you manage at work, right? I mean, you might have certain, you know, feel nervous if you go over budget or you've spent blah, 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 but you'll be able to explain that to your team or to the board or whatever. But at home, you manage a much smaller, considerably smaller budget, and yet you find that you can't do it. Clearly, it's not a case of you not being able to do that intellectually. There's something else, and that's the emotion. And that is what we need to work on before we move on to the practical stuff. Because you can read the practical stuff in a book, and you can just do it yourself. There's plenty of information online. I think what a coach does is offers you the possibility to come open, right, about you and money, your relationship with money, not just your bank account. It's part of it, but part of it is how you see yourself, how you position yourself towards money or against money. And the things that you believe that are possible for you, the things that you believe about yourself in relation to money, the things that you believe other people will think if you earn more or whatever. I'm writing now a case study based on a former client of mine. And this person was growing up, and their mother always said, if you don't control your money, it will always control you. But the mother didn't explain how can you control money. So this person, they were a software engineer, and they earned quite a bit of money in a relatively short period of time. They were kind of giving it all away, because it was their way of saying, the moment it leaves my hands, it's not my responsibility anymore. Therefore, I don't have to control all of this money.
Okay.
Otherwise, it will control me. So, you know, there's a lot of...
That sort of manifests as a rejection of it. If I don't have it on me, I don't need to worry about that kind of control relationship. I think that's one of the things I definitely see coming through in the work is elements of control. And it's not so much always about money. On the surface, as I said, it's often money seems to be a bit of a backstory, but it's about controlling my life. And I think it's very... money's like this surface manifestation, which is almost like I think you said, you know, it's an easy marker to kind of attach to. And you know, so what do you think is going on there? I mean, why is this such a fraught relationship?
I think it's possibly the meaning that we attach to money. So, you know, if you were growing up and you were always lacking, you kind of the meaning that you associate to money is this very scarce resource that, you know, is difficult to get a hold of, and probably when you do, it's very difficult to keep, right? Around this scarcity mindset is also the idea of, well, if you are going to have that money, someone else is going to lose out on it because there's a finite amount.
Zero-sum game.
There's only one pie, and the piece of pie that you take means that someone else will have to go without that kind of stuff. Mm. Versus someone who, you know, it can be the opposite. Someone who grew up in luxury and always had and was provided for whatever, and never actually appreciated money for, I don't want to say intrinsic value, because I don't necessarily believe it has intrinsic value. I think only humans and human, like alive beings, have intrinsic value, but they didn't appreciate it for its purchasing value or for the things that it could bring them, because it was never something that they had to desire for, right? They always had money, and therefore, when you don't understand that all of the things that you are provided with and everything that you have around you has a monetary price attached to it, the moment you are left without, it's like there's this disconnect of, so how do I get that back? Where, you know, where does the value of this object stand? And we, you know, there have been plenty of situations where people were asked, so how much does it cost to buy a loaf of bread? And they said like ridiculous sums, like £20 or whatever, because they just didn't have this connection with, you know, paying for something and seeing what that money can buy. So I think it's the meaning that we put on it, what we understand money to be and how we understand it to operate. I think for most people, from what I can see, is this idea of scarcity, that there isn't enough. Right. And there's, you know, if you take some, someone else will lose out, and it's a battle to, you know, to acquire more money. And sometimes it's being seen as a, if you have too much, you associate it with corruption and dishonesty, and the fact that someone must have done something dodgy to get all of this money, because all we honest people here are all kind of, you know, on the same level. So how can this be that something must be fishy around there?
It's like we're always reading into the story, the bigger story, with our money and what other people have in money.
Yeah.
And I think how I relate to this actually just might be, it's probably a good example, because money was security for me. Mm. And obviously, you know, as I say, growing up with that financial story about, oh, we're going to lose the house, it's no wonder money equals security for me. So in that sense, there was a lot of insecurity, because how am I ever going to make enough money to be secure? You know, I guess that was my story, if you like. And what I needed to do is understand that, yes, money is important, you know, for security. Of course it is, the world we live in, but it's not everything in terms of security. So I've had to find, you know, more sort of security within myself, if you like, and understand, you know, where my security comes from, my relationship, and understand it was interesting. I looked at my husband and I realized he doesn't have the same insecurities as me. And I thought it was normal. See, I thought it was normal to feel the way I was feeling. I thought that was how everybody felt, because I think that's the problem with beliefs, assumptions, is you think, well, this is just how it is, you know, until you understand and question them. Yeah. I think that was the meaning I was making there. Yeah.
So if we go back to my own story, because we couldn't rely so much on resources like money, I was raised up in the spirit of resourcefulness, right? So for me, if I wanted something, resources were the last thing that I would think of. I was brought up thinking, okay, let me listen to what's being said, to look around me, leverage my network, come up with ideas, do something to get that thing other than try and buy it. And to give you an example, that we had rationing when I was growing up, and you had these cards, and you know, you would go to the store and you would present the card, and on the card it would say, okay, this is a family of three, right? Because I counted as one person, mm-hmm. and then my parents, and they would give you certain amounts of food for the week or whatever. Resourcefulness meant that, for example, my dad, he was doing the military academy somewhere in a different city, and therefore, because he was also there and here, he needed to eat whilst he was there, so he had another car.
Right.
That was the resourcefulness, right? And because of that, and our neighbors kind of knew and whatever, we would help them with extra food if they needed. Uh-huh. Because sometimes if you would go in queue and you didn't have your little one with you or whatever, they wouldn't give you the extra, because it's, anyway, it was corruption and everything else involved. So being raised in a spirit of resourcefulness for me meant that I don't care that the money's not there, because I'm the one who's going to go after it or after something else anyway, right? So if I lose this money, I know that I can make more of it because it's up to me anyway. So it was never up to money. It was never up to how much money we had or didn't have. It was always up to what we can do about it. And from that, actually thinking now in hindsight, I created jobs for myself that didn't exist. Because I was, you know, always in the mindset of, well, I need to make it happen. There's no other option. I can't buy my way into it or anything like that. I just need to make it happen. It's up to me. So that was how, and you were talking about finding security within yourself. And that's a much more, you know, powerful way of relating to this. Because money comes and goes, and if you think about it, it's just a paper that's not worth its value. The value of the paper is not worth what's printed on it, right?
Yeah.
And it's an IOU, basically. It's just, and more papers can be printed if they need to print more, right?
Yeah.
I was reading in a book that in America, I think only about 4% of the money that's in circulation is actually represented in physical form.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's just a bunch of numbers changing on the screen. So if you think about it like that, the possibilities are infinite, aren't they?
Yeah, it's amazing. I love what you're talking about there about the resourcefulness, and that almost feels like that could be a really like good exercise to practice for anybody at any time. Oh, I want this. How can I get this without the money? And so it's almost like, well, I want to go and see a show maybe, but what's that show going to bring me? Well, it's going to bring me entertainment. So, well, how can I create entertainment for myself without money? So that's like, I love those kind of like exercises where you just open up stuff and you can create stuff, something from nothing. I love that kind of creativity. So I guess I really want to ask you about, you know, current times. I mean, I've stopped watching the news because I'm just sick of, like, you know, economic crisis. We all know we're in crisis. We all know that. And there's very little that we can do individually to have an effect on that. But, I mean, as I said, I've turned it off because I find it a trigger. You know, that's that security trigger. It triggers me and I think, oh my God, you know, what's going to become of us all, you know? I just don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so what would you say to anybody who's really, really feeling that right now, the kind of the insecurity that's created by the, you know, the economic environment?
Mm. Well, what you're doing, I think, is a good strategy. I don't watch the news, not even before the pandemic. I just get my news very succinctly from specific websites that I know are not going to go onto a tangent and say crazy things from a tiny little thing that's happened somewhere in this world.
Making meaning out of nothing, which I guess is...
Yeah. So doing that kind of protecting yourself, but also having some sort of mechanism to block whatever's coming your way, because of course there might be other people around you who say things or who go crazy about, have you heard about this? And oh my God, it's, I find that it's okay to acknowledge it and then to filter it through my own. I try and say to myself, how many things, not a pandemic, but similar to this in terms of economic effects, have happened in the past and we have survived, the economy has recovered. if you think about it, someone was asking me the other day on LinkedIn, they have a friend who's very nervous about their investments. And I said, I haven't checked my investments since this thing happened. I just don't go in. What I do is I continue to contribute every month because I know that I am in the market for the long run. And in 30 years' time, this will just be a hiccup on the graph because I expect the market to go up the same way as it has done for the last 100 of years. So I'm not going to start to believe now that it's all going to go down. And, you know, when things are going well, we think it's going to be forever. And when things are going bad, we think it's going to be forever. And yeah, it never is. There's cycles in the economy and in the political environment and everything that's happening. And I'm not saying, you know, be delusional about, oh, everything's great right now. What are you talking about? It's not. But it's not the first time that it happens. It won't be the last time. And the life just doesn't stop. The fact that we are anxious about something doesn't mean that we can stop and not go to work and not take care of our families and not, you know, because we are anxious about it or whatever. Nobody will stop for us. And therefore, we have to find a way to just move forward and work with it as it is now. But if we can protect ourselves from exaggeration and from, you know, I was reading, I get some notifications on my phone. And the moment they opened the pubs, the second day, I was getting notifications saying, I don't know how many deaths happened. And I was thinking, hold on a second. If they happened, it's not because they opened the pubs, because you don't just die like this from coronavirus, right? Yeah. It takes a while for it to, you know, this is grim, so maybe not go into so much detail, but it wasn't because of that. But of course, if you're not a reputable source and you want people to read your stuff, you will make it more than what it is, right? So
It's like attracting attention through the story. And so I guess what you're saying now, what I really like actually is that it's not, and I think this is, you talked about how, you know, if it's bad, we think it's forever. If it's good, we think it's forever, you know, and I really love that because I think what the problem is at the moment is that we've got the 24 news hour channels and they're reporting the same thing hour after hour that, oh, this is bad and it's getting worse and it's getting worse and it's getting worse. But you're talking about like minute sections of time, but actually what you need to do is look at the long story of it, the full picture. And it was interesting, I had a guest on last week and he was talking with a leadership coach and we were talking about some of the changes we'd seen since the last economic crisis and how it had impacted the millennial mindset, which is people coming into the workplace now and thinking, well, you know, how long is it going to take for me to afford to buy a house? I'm not prepared to make that kind of investment anymore. Work has become about more than earning money. So it's become much more meaning and purpose filled. And that's like a really positive impact from the last economic crisis. So I came away from that with a lot of hope. And
And I can relate to that. Like, I'm a millennial and I didn't find the meaning that I was hoping to find in my employed work. Hence, I started my own business. Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, I was being paid quite well. That was nothing to complain about, but it was the impact that I was making that wasn't significant enough for me. And for that, I was willing to make the jump into building something that, you know, not many people know about. Financial coaching, especially in the UK, it's quite new. I mean, there are people in this space, but it's not like executive coaching, which has been around for a while now. People know exactly what you do. You have to, you know, explain it to people. Some people go, oh, so you're this woo-woo kind of talking about relationship with money. What is that anyway? So, you know, but I was willing to make that jump because what I was doing as an accountant and as an analyst was only shifting some numbers in a spreadsheet. And I wanted to move beyond that. So, yeah, I can definitely relate to work being more than just an avenue to make money, and that's it.
Yeah, that's great. We'll open up in a minute for anybody who wants to come in and ask any questions or make a contribution. It's really welcome if you want to do that, but don't feel forced to, because we will have some time after the recording too. I know people are listening to the recording really appreciate it if somebody comes on asking a question, because you might just have the question that everybody's thinking that we haven't spoken about here. So we'll just carry on, and if anybody comes in, we'll stop. So we'll bear that in mind. And I think, I guess to sum up what I'm hearing you saying, perhaps it's about making money, or seeing money as more of a practical resource rather than this whole kind of the meaning and story behind it. Would that be right?
I would say it's a means to an end in terms of the practical things that you do with it. And I always, when I work with my clients, we talk about their goals, not necessarily in terms of what are your financial goals and that's it. We talk about all of their goals, because I see finances as something that can support other areas in your life, right? Mm. If you only have financial goals, and you don't have personal goals and family goals and social and relationship goals, whatever, when you get there, you will not find happiness.
Exactly. What are you going to do with it all?
Yeah, you're just going to hoard it,
like
count
Scrooge,
it every day.
Like Scrooge, isn't it? Count his money every day.
Exactly. So I do see it as a means to an end. At the same time, from a mindset point of view, if you want, I just see it as energy. And yeah. I see everything as energy, including us. So, you know, when you look at it as energy, some of the things that we say to ourselves they sound ridiculous. So, for example, I don't deserve money versus I don't deserve energy. What? Who doesn't deserve energy? Why wouldn't you deserve energy? You are energy, right? So if you think about it as energy and everything around us is energy, it's like, you know, it's not so alien anymore. It's reachable, like everything else, like this desk, like this computer, like someone else who you can touch. Money is reachable too, because it's made out of the same energy. And I know it's a bit esoteric, but energy also kind of moves around all the time. It's not static. So this works really well for people who are trying to hold on to money because they're afraid they're not going to be able to get it back, right? So if you have this fear that, you know, one day you'll go bankrupt or whatever, the moment you make the money, it's really difficult for you to then spend that money. And it keeps you in a miserable position, because you'll be this person with a bunch of money in their bank account and afraid to do anything with it. Life is about living. So you sometimes have to spend that money, trusting that more will come back, because energy is always flowing and it's always moving. So I see it both as a practical means to an end, but also as part of the world, in the same way that everything is energy.
Mm. That's really good. I love that concept. And it's almost like, if you can relate that to anything, like you're saying, of course we need energy as human beings to be able to function. So like you say, that could come through food, it could come through sleep, it could come through exercise, it could come through, you know, our creativity, and, you know, so it could come through money as well. So it's just another energy source in that sense. And that makes it much more, I guess, like you said, it's taking away the meaning from all of that. I love how you say it's like, well, how can you say you don't deserve this, you know?
Yeah, or I don't need money versus I don't need energy.
Yeah.
Who doesn't need energy, right?
I don't need money, I don't need it. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, nobody seems to want to come on and ask a question. That's fine, we will turn off the recording in a moment. So is there anything that you'd like to say just to finish off, Elisa? Any final thoughts?
I don't know what, you know, everyone's situation is, and I wouldn't be able to say something to apply to their particular circumstances. But I think there is there's one thing that applies to everyone, and that is, you know, the way you treat money is the way money will treat you. And if you don't think that you treat it in some way, look at how you spend a month with your money. From the moment it reaches your bank account, let's say that you receive your salary or whatever, or you know, you draw money from your business as an owner. What happens to that money and to you once from that date onwards for the next 30 days? Because some people, the quicker they get it, they just throw it away. They spend it. They don't spend any time sitting with that money. They're not comfortable having the money, or they're always thinking in negative terms about it. Why are you so scarce, right? I need it more of you. You know, there's never this satisfaction of, I'm just going to appreciate the money that I have now, knowing that if I want more money, more will come. They either come from a place of, I don't want it, take it away, because they feel guilty about having it, whatever, or I need more of it, why are you so little? Never being able to be in an appreciative state around the money that they have. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what's happening within a month with the money that you receive, apart from, you know, you have to pay for your mortgage or your rent and food and all of that kind of stuff, there's also a lot of things that we pay for that we're almost like throwing money away. And by that I mean things that we don't use, subscriptions, all sorts of stuff that we are you know, we're paying on a regular basis and we never even check. That money is neglected, right? So that reflects in the relationship. There's also things that we are willing to spend money on, but don't actually bring us the value that we were expecting. And therefore, we are devaluing money by doing that. If you are, you know, spending quite a lot on some sort of service that you don't actually use, or you have three of them, Netflix, HBO Go, and Prime, right? That is kind of like almost not valuing that money enough to say, you know, one is enough and with the rest I'll do something more meaningful.
Yeah.
So start looking at your bank account and see what story that is telling.
Yeah.
And that's how you can start to uncover the story that's inside you about money.
What you're saying, it sounds like it's almost like a check, you know, your energy related to the money that you have, you know. Yeah, that sounds like that kind of energy check. That's brilliant. Thank you. So, Lisa, just to finish up, what are you available for and where can people find you?
Right now, I am available on most social media platforms. So I'm on LinkedIn, I have a Facebook page, I have an Instagram page. But the one that's taking a lot of my time and energy is YouTube now. I post there once a week. I have a video every Tuesday. But it takes me a long time to just post once a week. But so that is more for business owners and early stage entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs who want to learn about the business side of, you know, being your own boss, but also the mind element of it. So I talk about money and finance, but I also talk about business and I talk about mindset and how to manage your mind around all of this.
Yeah.
Because the way you are with your finances personally will reflect in how your financial situation is professionally. So you can find me there. I do a lot of stuff, but if you want to go more in depth into the how to build a financially viable business, I have a course that I teach for the University of Cambridge. The next one is in October, at the end of October. So that's a 2-day course where we go through, you know, what you need to set in place to make sure that your business is going off the ground in the right way. And of course, they can contact me if they want to work one-to-one, either on their personal finances or their business, or mostly both.
Yeah. Okay. I'll make sure I put links to all of that. And just to say, you know, shout out for your YouTube channel. There's some great content on there and covering so many different aspects to do with money and business. And yeah, I think you did one about getting what happens when you get a rejection in your business and, you know, stuff like that. So it's great resource, great value that.
Thank you.
So, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been a real pleasure to have you. I'll turn off the recording in just a moment. But just to say that next week we have Yannick Jacob coming on. He is a positive psychologist and existential coach. And we're going to be talking about our subject is using and abusing positivity. So how to use positivity without getting lost up in that kind of getting lost in, you know, just trying to be positive all the time, which is something that I really rail against. So Yannick has made a really great contribution to the book that I'm writing now. So it's going to be a real pleasure to have him on here. And just to say, if you want to join us, you're very welcome. Love having people here live. And if not, you can always make a contribution through my website, which is oliviadesilva.com/contribution. So you can go on there, you can ask me anything or share something, or you can tell me where self-doubt is showing up in your life and we'll bring it here and talk about it. There's that. And also just to say on the recording that I'll be sending out with this, you can see the upcoming schedule of who's going to be coming on, and you can, and there is a link on there now about you can add it to your calendar for next week, so you're never going to miss me. So thank you for everybody here who's joined us here live today. Thank you to everybody who's watched the recording. Thank you, Elisa, once again for your time, and I'll see you next week.